Let's see. We're getting marks from me, which is good. Good.
You're getting stuff from me?
Yeah, we are. So we're
good.
Cooking with gas.
Let's go.
Let's do that. Okay, it is Monday, the 27th of September, 2021. I am Patrick Crozier.
I'm Brian McElfoyt.
And normally at this stage we state what the topic of discussion is, but in our sort of pre-discussion, we decided that we weren't going to do that anymore. We were going to decide what the topic of the discussion was after we've had our chat.
I think that's wise.
Sorry, Brian, you cut out there a bit. What were you saying?
Idea of what they're going to hear.
Unfortunately, there was a dropout there. Can you start from the beginning again, where you said? I think you said you said it was a wise idea. I'm sorry, Brian. It's all I can hear from you is a sort of muffle. Now, given that, when you rang me on your mobile to my mobile, it worked absolutely fine.
Well, let's try that.
Oh, you're back. You're back.
I'm back, am I?
Yeah, you are. So I can hear you. Have you moved around the room at all? Have you changed ear?
No, I haven't. I've not touched anything.
Right, okay. Obviously,
something. Well, anyway, this is September 27th, 2021. You're Patrick Crozier and I'm Brian McElfoy.
Yeah. And
we're having difficulty because I'm basically in a 24-hour care place because of my medical difficulties. But we're going to go ahead anyway and hope for the best.
Yes, we are.
And you're going to set the agenda because your question, as I recall, the beginning of all this, was who were the best rulers of the medieval era? What sort of king did you want to have?
Yeah,
is that right? Have I got that about right?
Yes, and the reason I ask is because whenever you read about, well, I don't read about medieval history, but I watch documentaries about it, and it doesn't matter which king it is, anyone you've heard of, whether it's Richard the First or John or Henry the Third, or all these people, they're all dreadful. They're all absolutely dreadful. And I ask that question, who was the best, simply to try to sort of separate the wheat from the, well, perhaps not the wheat from the chaff, maybe the chaff from the chaff, the better chaff from the worst chaff. In that, you know, some kings are better than others, even though by our standards they might be bloody awful. That's what I was after.
Yeah. Well, my basic reaction is that if you're going to have a king, he's going to be warlike, because that's what they were all like in those days. And you'd rather he had his wars in foreign countries than on top of your home. That's the main distinction I'd offer.
Yeah. My response to that is Richard the First, who really had his wars a long way away. And
yes, he did.
As far as I'm aware, he was still a dreadful king.
Yes.
Because to finance these wars, he taxed people like crazy. I say that, and then today I was listening to a podcast, and they were talking about King John, and they said King John increased taxation by 6 times in England, so mainly because he'd lost Normandy. So maybe that's not as simple as it sounds. But that's always the problem about reading history or listening to history, is that it will challenge your neat, you know, preconceptions.
Well, I was offering that thing about foreign wars as, you know, given the choice between Henry V and Henry VI, you'd probably prefer Henry V if you were English.
Yes. Oh, but didn't
Not
you say...
Because
didn't...
he died and therefore didn't get a chance to become old and senile and have his wars in the south of England.
Sorry, you sort of dropped out there just a little bit. Who are you talking about here?
Henry V.
Henry V, yeah. Yeah, he didn't get old and senile, yeah.
He died quite young in a siege, I think, in France, northern France somewhere. And so we never experienced an old Henry V having wars in the south of England, which would have been worse.
Yeah.
I take your point about King John and Richard I and all that.
Although I think
it makes a... Go on.
I seem to remember you saying, actually, that some historians claim that the War of the Roses was actually quite peaceful.
Yes. I mean, medieval wars were very local affairs in that the armies were very small compared to the countries they were careering out in. And certainly the Wars of the Roses seem to have allowed, as I recall, the east of England to rather sort of ignore it all. Which is quite a good way to do it.
Yeah. Well, presumably they were, as we were saying earlier, you know, they might have avoided the fighting, but they probably didn't avoid the taxation.
Mm. Well, I think they did, actually. I think the Wars of the Roses took the minds of the ruling class off taxing other people and put them on fighting each other, which in some ways was a blessed relief for the populace.
Oh, okay.
That's what I think I've read. But what do you reckon? Who do you think are the best monarchs of that time, or the least worst?
Yeah, you'll laugh at this one. I'm going to go for Henry III.
Yeah, I agree, actually, because he was a successful fighter abroad. He fought the Battle of Crecy, didn't he?
Oh, that was Edward III.
Edward III.
Henry III reigned for 50 years. And he was King John's son, I believe. His reign coincided with Simon de Montfort's rebellion and the calling of the Parliament. But I think that's a good thing, that a Parliament was called. And, you know, as institutions, government institutions go, I know we tend to be a bit against government generally, but, you know, that was probably a good thing. And certainly an institution that lasted, well, kept going until now.
As far as the people at the time were concerned, it probably wasn't a big deal that it was all going to last a long time in the future.
No, it's all today's problem.
In a similar spirit, I'd offer Henry II, because he founded what we now call the common law. His attitude to law was very interesting, as I understand it. He didn't care what the verdict was. He just wanted a verdict. He wanted it settled. He wanted peace so that the money that the barons accumulated could go to him directly in taxation rather than be frittered away on fighting. So his principle was, if there was a fight going on between a couple of aristocrats, his principle was, if one aristocrat brought the case in front of the king's justices and the other one refused to, the other one lost automatically.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting idea. The idea that you let legal content go where it wants to and you obsess about the procedure.
Sorry, legal content. The actual judgment
content
itself.
The verdicts, yes.
Yeah.
I think it probably did some good at the time, given the choice was between the king settling disputes between aristocrats and failing to.
I mean, I suppose power has something to do with, hasn't it? Because it puts him in, I was going to say, the driving seat.
Oh, yeah. I mean, his objective wasn't altruistic. He was just trying to. He just wanted the money not to be wasted by aristocrats killing each other. You know.
Yeah. I mean, do we know if there were examples of aristocrats refusing to attend the king's courts?
I don't know. I don't know much of the detail about how this worked. All I know is that by having the rule that if you presented your case to the king and the other fellow didn't, you won, that was a strong incentive to present your case and therefore keep the peace. I don't know how much people deviated from that ever.
Probably not, seeing as that if you didn't show up, you know, it's not only that your enemy would be the existing aristocrat, but also be the king, which is not a good position to be in unless you've got some really good friends. And I suppose one of the things is that it forces people, rather than to use a physical force method, they have to use their intelligence and they have to assemble evidence and they have to present that evidence.
Yeah.
Which is
a step in the right direction.
Yeah, it's absolutely a step in the right direction.
Even though even though people hated lawyers at the time because they were the people who benefited from this,
yeah.
But rather lawyers than warriors.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I suppose what we're saying is a strong and intelligent king. Henry II was famously energetic. People never knew where he was going to be at any particular moment. He would go on long journeys in a very short time. So I think there was something to be said for having a monarch who was capable in physically able to pull off these stunts and keep the aristocracy in a state of anxiety about the king's power. I think there's a sense in which regular people don't want the aristocracy quarrelling with each other.
What would it
They'd
do?
They'd rather
for,
have the king in charge.
What would it do for regular people if the aristocracy quarrelled? Just the normal result of a medieval war.
One of the basic techniques of medieval warfare was spoiling for a fight. If you had an army which you thought was going to beat the other fellow's army, he would often avoid battle. And in order to get battle, you would torment his workers, his peasantry, who were treated rather like farm animals by all parties. So spoiling for a fight was a literal phrase.
Hmm.
You literally would spoil the territory of the other fellow to make him come to battle against you.
Right.
And that's very bad news for the people who live there, isn't it?
Pretty much. There's a little point about confusion. It is, my understanding was, these nobles, what we're talking about, either the Earl of Northumberland and the Duke of Norfolk and these sorts of titles, is they would have a title which is of a territory, but it wasn't quite as like that. They would have territory all over the place.
Yes.
Rather odd model.
I think in general, territories were less solidly defined than they are now.
Yeah. Well, maybe they didn't have the ability to survey the land so easily. That was sort of the idea behind the Domesday Book, wasn't it? So that you knew where everyone was and what everyone had.
Also, I think national frontiers, such as they were a lot harder to defend than they are now, because there just weren't enough people, you know, and communication was very bad.
And so, in those days, of course, the English Channel wasn't a moat.
No, it was more like an easy trip. There's a myth going around that, or been going around for a long time, that medieval England was never invaded. Rubbish, it was invaded constantly by quite small armies, because you never knew where these armies were going to land. Often they didn't know themselves. They would set sail and just land on the coast and start marching towards London.
If they
were popular, they would amass an army as they travelled.
I know there was a King Louis of France who invaded, I think it's during John's time. Any others we know about?
Well, Roger Mortimer, who overthrew, I think, Edward II, he invaded England successfully and rather speculatively, but it worked.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the as you say, the English Channel wasn't the moat that it became later. And the reason it became a moat was because you could put people all along the edge of it and keep in touch with them.
It wasn't easy,
but it was easier. It became easier.
Yeah, I mean, some people claim that the Glorious Revolution was in fact a Dutch invasion.
It was. It was a coup d'état.
A popular coup d'état, I would point out.
Well, it was certainly popular with the people who organised it.
Yes, indeed. But it wasn't there was some opposition, wasn't there? I think King James did attempt to stop it. He got a bleeding nose, a nosebleed, and then ran away, which was a disaster for him. So it could be done. Henry VII, of course, I think he's another example, isn't he? He was exiled to France and somehow got an army together and deposed Richard III.
Mm-mm.
So, it could be done.
Yes.
with an unpopular king, certainly.
Mm. Oh, yes. I mean, as Richard II is all about this. I forget who... I think one of the things that happened during that era was when people would become the king, the head of state, through sheer self-defence, because the alternative was to be executed by their predecessor.
But I thought it was quite a difficult thing to do, because you did not want to be seen as a usurper, did you?
Oh, that's right. It was difficult, but if the alternative was certain death, you gave it a go, you know.
Right. What examples are there of that? Would Henry IV well, come into this?
I think Richard II was deposed by... Who was it? I can't remember now.
It was Henry IV, actually, come to think of it, yes.
Yes, Henry IV, that's right.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
Bolingbroke. And there was all sorts of doubts about his legitimacy that Shakespeare goes into, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but they all, the way Shakespeare tells it, they all evaporated with Henry V.
Yeah. Well, we've got to be careful here about Shakespeare's history, don't we?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
But I think what Shakespeare said about all this is vaguely relevant, because so much of history was myth. It was just made up, and it was fiction that was accepted or not.
Well, yes, which makes this conversation kind of difficult, doesn't it?
Because
how much of what we think is true was true.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not as if you have multiple sources, a national press where you have a debate raging about not only the facts but the interpretation of those facts. In those days, you might have, well, very few sources. Maybe you'd always get discontented barons on the losing side who might say a thing or two. I simply don't know. Or monks. I suppose it's monks who were doing all the writing in those days, wasn't it?
Yes, I think so.
So,
but they were very different times to ours, weren't they? As you say.
Yeah.
And even the best news was pretty bad, often. I mean, it was a miserable time to be alive compared to now, for almost everybody.
Yeah. Well, let's put some flesh on those bones. Life expectancy was shorter. Child death and child mortality was enormous. Lots of horrible diseases like the Black Death could wipe out huge numbers. There were famines frequently. I mean, you name it, really. It was tough. Plus,
famous graph of human happiness, or comfort anyway, which is horizontal until the end of the 18th century. And then it takes off like a rocket.
Yeah.
And it's been rocketing upwards ever since.
Mm.
Despite all the woke nonsense and all the universities being places inflicting nonsense on the world, or trying to. Despite all of that, despite lots of reactionary opposition to modernity, modernity has really continued ever since, and is still the most important idea in the world, I would say, despite everything.
Yeah. I'll give an example of that. I gave you this one when we had our initial discussion. It was in my teenage years, I was a bit of a green. And it was something my mother would always say to me is, I hope it doesn't apply to me, because I was brought up on a farm and I don't want to go back there. Thank you very much.
Yes, exactly.
And yeah, it wasn't until quite a lot later. Of course, it was not until quite a lot later I realised what she was talking about.
Yeah. A great many of the people who poured into the cities in the 19th century to work in factories were very happy to do that. They, as far as they were concerned, this was a step up.
Is that true? I mean, that is something that's... You know, the left, I think, will often dispute. I mean, is it absolutely beyond dispute, do you think?
I think for a lot of these people, it really was an improvement. For the reasons your mother says.
So it's not a case of simply the sort of agrarian revolution, as I was taught about at school, increased the number of actually reduced the number of labourers needed, so they were made unemployed, so they had to go somewhere else.
No, I don't think that's the full story by any means. I think there was a wealth explosion.
Yeah.
And it was happening in the cities, and people wanted to be part of it.
Hmm. Even with the smog and the dark satanic mills.
Yeah, all that stuff. But the thing was that when this got underway, there were improvements of all kinds being unleashed. Things like better sewage systems in the cities to clean up. London was famously disgusting in the 19th century.
This is the great stink of, I think, the 1840s.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But they cleaned it up, you know.
Yeah.
They made it work. And names like Bazalgette get thrown around now, and quite rightly.
That bloke who figured out where all the cholera is coming from one standpipe.
Yes, that's right.
And Semmelweis, although he didn't do him much good, working out that actually if you cleaned your hands, your patients have a better chance of surviving.
Yeah.
If you're a doctor.
It wasn't just improvements in things like steam engines and factory machinery. It was procedures and local government. I always think that the phrase municipal socialism is rather misleading, because it implies that municipalities could have avoided municipal socialism and should have done. But I think they probably made the right decision to get together and fix their problems.
Less
corruptible local government. I think it only later got way out of hand. I believe
the Metropolitan Board of Works was horribly corrupt.
It wasn't a perfect picture, but it made sense that if you were faced with corrupt local government, the answer was uncorrupt local government, rather than no local government at all, in a sort of purist libertarian style.
Well, I like to be a purist libertarian as much as I can. I like to believe that private alternatives could work. I mean, although the more I think about it, the more I tend to, you know, do these thought experiments, the more I do, and I did this a lot when I was, you know, writing for Transport Blog. And thinking about railways and roads, and the more I would come back to some form of government, I think the thing that did it for me here was thinking about buses, because buses, first of all, have to use roads and they have to stop on those roads, so therefore they need bus stops. Therefore, they kind of need a power that will allow them to use the road and stop on those roads and put up a bus stop, allow them to put up the physical infrastructure to do this. And you're going
to
be...
It's very hard to see how you could build a new and cleaner and better sewer in a place like London without lots of politics.
Mm.
You know, property rights and all sorts of things having to be just... There comes a moment when you say, well, we've got to have this sewer... This is the least worst place to have it. And I'm sorry, if you own the land there, you're going to have to surrender it.
I mean,
you can argue about the price, but the principle seems rather hard to avoid.
On that point, I did once read a book, you'd be surprised to hear, on the very subject of the Great Stink. And what I hadn't realised is that sewers have been around for centuries. And the problem started when they legalised the flush toilet.
Oh.
And prior to that, basically you had to use a cesspit. And that's where all solid waste went. So you had cesspit, you had people who came along and, you know, not a nice job, and dug it all out and you know, put it somewhere useful. But as soon as people were dumping this stuff into the sewers, it went straight into the Thames and caused your stink for you.
Well, at that point, you have a decision to make, do you? Do you want nice water closets in every home, in which case you have to have a new sewer, or are you going to go without?
Yeah.
I know which I'd prefer.
Yes, indeed. I suppose, yeah, and you're prepared to pay the extra for, you know, all that sewer work and, building and maintenance, but I guess people were. Yeah, how do we go into that? Well, we were talking about how
life has improved. Well, we were talking about what a miserable time it was before all this improvement started happening. Because pretty much... I mean, I read a book about 18th century warfare not long ago, and it was everywhere and relentless. All the time, these people were just conquering each other's countries.
Is that just us British, or is it beyond Europe?
No, it's everywhere.
Brian, you dropped out there. The last thing I heard you say, it was everywhere.
Yeah. Well, the warfare was.
It wasn't just
the Western European countries fighting each other for command of the seas. It was also China getting as big as it's ever been at that time.
Oh, right, okay.
And North India and Afghanistan and all these... It was just relentless. And if you were a young man of military age, that's probably what you would end up being made to do.
I thought that was not the case, simply because so many people were necessary to just do the farming. There's a big change, and why the World War One is such a big matter, big issue, and why it's regarded as such sadness.
Let me rephrase that.
Yeah, okay.
Achieve honor and glory in such a world was military, and if you didn't do it by those means, you didn't get it at all. The way to be someone was to be a soldier.
Ah, right.
That was it.
Okay.
Whereas since then, crucially, you could be someone by making a better toilet or a better sewage system or a better, you know, washing hands in the hospital. That was an honorable life.
Like it Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and...
yes, all these people.
George Soros. Yeah, okay.
Right. And all the others, not just the famous ones, the big names, the people who spend their lives making toilet paper slightly better.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the change that's happened, that we're no longer dependent on military glory to achieve any glory in the world. We can achieve it without those horrible methods.
Wow. Because there was no other way of doing it. I'm just thinking, you think about, say, the City of London, and you think about these guilds, and they've been around since the Middle Ages.
Yeah, you have to modify this and say that in the luckier countries like England, which had its moat, which gradually became more and more militarily effective, it was possible to live a peaceful and productive life. But the big change was the end of the 18th century, when that suddenly became important in a way it hadn't been before.
Yeah. Would it be that by that stage you get this constant improvement?
Yes.
There's, within your lifetime you will see things change.
Yes.
For the better. Well, in theory, for the better. I'm sure that people complain about railroads.
At the end of the 18th century, energy suddenly exploded in a way which I think...
Sorry, we're talking about coal here, are we all?
Coal is the big one in England.
Yeah.
And the National Railway System, of course,
mm-hmm.
Which was a huge event when it happened.
Yeah.
And but above all, the feeling among the people who did it, you know, the financiers and the inventors who made all this happen, that this was a great way to get ahead in the world. I saw a play in Newcastle which was about George Stephenson, and he used the phrase, when he realized just how great the railways could be, when he began to see what they could turn into, he was reported in this play as saying, here is a means by which a man can make his way in the world. In other words, people were thinking about improvement in a whole new and optimistic way, which previously they hadn't been doing. They'd done business, they'd had capital, they'd had savings, they'd made profits, but none of it really counted for very much.
And maybe there was always that slight disdain with which merchants, especially if they were Jews...
More than somewhat slight, yeah. I would say.
Yeah.
There was a transformation. This is what Deborah McCloskey argues, and I agree with her. but that there was a transformation.
Deirdre
McCloskey, yes. Yeah. That the bourgeois virtues, to some extent, replaced the old aristocratic and military virtues, and not before time.
Wow.
And the good news is that with many doubts and hesitations, the whole world copied it, copied this. The British Revolution, which I think Deirdre McCloskey describes, was the most successful of the national revolutions of Europe.
Hmm.
And has been the most important history date in the last 1,000 years.
Oh, hang on. I know we did a big long podcast about this. We are talking about the revolution that occurred sometime between 1688 and about 1830, yes?
Well, there were two. The thing is, there were two stages to the revolution. Whenever you get these, whenever mass literacy works its magic, you start with a huge fight about who's in charge. And that happens everywhere. And it's nasty and it's very bloody and destructive. And most people try and keep their heads down. This happened in Germany. Germany and Austria was the first of these big events because they were the first to get to literacy. But the Germans and the Austrians had quite different preoccupations to the English. They were interested in, you know, symphonic music and poetry and philosophy and rather windy and pious ideas about the rights of man and the brotherhood of man, which is all very well, but it doesn't tell you where the next meal's coming from.
But they did get Beethoven, Mozart.
Oh, yeah, I at least got that. I mean, it's a source of great amusement to me that the two things that happened in the world in the last God knows how long were, first of all, the wealth explosion, and the other was the classical music thing that happened in Germany and Austria, and they both happened at exactly the same time. And nothing more perfectly illustrates the contrasting preoccupations of the Germans and the English. And at the beginning of the 19th century, the Germans were famous for not having any factories, for just not making any economic progress. Karl Marx lampooned the Germans. He talked about the German ideology as being an economic failure, which it was. I mean, they didn't solve their economic problems. They only got to grips with them when the English were clearly doing wonderfully well and the Germans decided to copy them. They did it by rethinking their universities.
And boy, did they manage it.
Yes.
Everything I know about, which is not much, about 19th century German universities and in 19th century German industrialization is it's brilliant. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's not just they're copying the English, they are working out how it works.
Yeah.
I mean, an example would be Mises and Hayek, I suppose.
Mm.
Slightly off, but
no, I think
sorry,
I agree.
But they systemized things that the English had discovered without really thinking about what they were doing.
Yes,
and Mises comes along and says, "This is what you're doing, and this is why it works."
Mm. Yes, yes, I agree with that.
And I think that probably applied to 100 other industries like steel and chemicals and
electrical. And I mean the Germans. I mean, there's a big argument about whether technology causes science or science causes technology. Well, to start with, it was the gadgeteers were telling the scientists what science was, which the scientists were getting wrong.
Was it?
I mean,
examples?
The people who made the steam engines knew a great deal more about gas under pressure than the official scientists.
Oh.
Which happens a lot.
Wow.
But the Germans kind of turned that around and started with educating people in the science, assuming that this would result in lots of stuff, and it did.
Yeah.
It also resulted in all sorts of turmoil and Nazism and things like that. So it wasn't all good news. But economically, it began as very good news.
Well, I can live with the idea of two steps forward, one step back. You're still one step forward with that. I can also live with the idea that Twill is human, that humans make mistakes, and there are examples of that. And I can, I've even, you know, developed my Crozier monarchy theory to say, well, you know, when monarchies
completely fits that perfectly, because the aristocracy never gives up without fight.
No, indeed not.
And they never have.
Nope,
there's always a fight between the new men, the new middle classes, the middling sort of people, and the old bosses. And I don't know of any case where that hasn't happened. But the second phase, which is what the middling people think about how to make mankind happier and more successful, that is very contrasting. There are hardly two revolutions that are the same as each other.
No.
I mean, the German Revolution began as, and really remained as a collective effort to achieve mass literacy so that individuals could have their own proper relationship with God and they could read the Bible in their own language and all that sort of stuff. And then the English Revolution, that was the big one, in my opinion. That was the most successful revolution there's ever been, so much so that we're now quite used to the idea that revolutionaries are idiots. So we literally don't see, or a lot of people don't see, can't see, that the British Revolution was a truly extraordinary event.
Yeah, and as you say, it had ideologists behind it, or ideology behind
it. Yes, exactly. These ideologists thought they were going to have a sort of liftoff, like a jet taking off from an airport. But in fact, they got more than that. They got a rocket taking off from a standing start, pretty much.
Yeah.
And it was extraordinary. And it took the Germans about a century to get used to what was happening and to understand it and do their own version of it. The French Revolution was a claim that there should be a strong state and a secular state. And it didn't do much harm. The French Revolution was very bloody and very destructive and achieved very little indeed, except the further diminution of French power. I mean, Napoleon, if you look at what he achieved for France, it's a minus quantity.
Right.
And I suspect a lot of French people still haven't quite absorbed that, don't understand that in the same sort of way that there was bad news for Germany, Napoleon was, in a modified way, very bad news for France.
My understanding is there is quite a lot of ambivalence in France about Napoleon.
Yeah, because they still fancy the military glory. I think.
Well, I think yes, I think it would be. I think a lot of people would like that sort of thing. But there's also a sense of, well, actually, this came at a price. Because a lot of men died, and ultimately he lost.
He lost. And by the time he'd finished, he'd pretty much handed we can see with hindsight that he'd handed the superpower spot to England, and France was no longer a factor.
Because of Britain's dominance of the sea throughout the Napoleonic period, actually, it was never ceded. And, this goes back to the Seven Years' War.
It was quite anxious time for the English, and it was also a very expensive time for them. The taxes that were paid to fight that war were very, very burdensome.
Yes.
With the Battle of Waterloo and the ending of the Napoleonic era, the world, led by Britain, did its economic takeoff, and the French got the hang of it, not too badly. They learned what they should be doing and they started doing it, and the Germans the same. But then you had these Russian and Chinese rebellions where the middling sort of people believed disastrously destructive things.
Are we talking about Maoist China or the Tientsin Rebellion?
Yeah. Well, the Chinese had what they called their Great Leap Forward, which is nothing of the kind. And the Russians had their Stalinist atrocities, again, disastrous, for Russia, and insofar as the world was stupid enough to copy it, it was disastrous for the world.
Well, you'll have no dispute for me there. Yes. Although, if one wandered onto Twitter, you would have all sorts of people claiming Stalin was a great guy.
Oh, I know. Mad.
Yeah, mad. Is Russia today better off than it was in 1914? It probably is, actually.
Well,
it probably
might be a little bit with mobile phones and railways and things, but the general opinion among those who study Russia is that the big disappointment economically of the 20th century was Russia. That if you contrast how Russia was looking in about 1910 and how Russia ended up in 2010,
it's a horrible disappointment. The Times published a supplement in 1914 or 1913 all about, you know, how things are going great guns in Russia and how they were, industrializing and everything was great there. I put this down to it's very difficult to modernize your economy without modernizing your politics. I'll give this example.
That because the English political settlement was a bodge. It wasn't a victory for the new people. The House of Commons didn't destroy the House of Lords. There are still aristocrats making the running in the beginning of the 20th century in England.
No, absolutely. The Times is fascinating in this. You really, it was a real eye-opener to me, is just how important the old aristocrats were and how they would constantly get mentioned. Mm-hmm. Even in 1914, you think, what?
Yeah,
they were a big deal. In a way, well, who cares?
So England was a compromise, and it also because it went from being a rather precarious power when the Protestant Reformation hit England. I'm talking about the times of Elizabeth I and the Armada, those sort of moments. Went from that to world supremacy, and it took a long time. Not surprising.
Can I suggest that in one sense it wasn't a compromise, in that the power of the monarch, I mean, you go from Charles I talking about the divine right of kings to Anne, who essentially was a constitutional monarch that we're familiar with today.
Well, if you regard a constitutional monarchy as a massive improvement over a Charles I monarchy, which I think is reasonable, then that makes sense.
Yeah,
but I don't think the radicals of the 17th century got what they wanted.
No, in England. No, although they probably did during the interregnum, and then people just got fed up of not having any theatres or having to wear black all the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that did for them. A typical example of revolutionaries going too far and burning themselves out.
But you have to understand that each revolution had at least two faces to it. There was the argument about who was in charge, which happened everywhere and was bloody everywhere, and then the argument about what the new men were bringing to the world, and that varied every time.
Yeah.
And as I say, the British version of that was by far the most significant and successful, in contrast with, say, the Russian and Chinese dramas. I mean, the Chinese at least knew how to do the British stuff when they felt inclined. But as we now know, they have a horrible habit of switching back to the old ways when they feel they've got enough money, and the question is, you know, who do they steal it from and what places do they try and conquer around them?
Yeah, yes. We're talking about Xi, aren't we? I mean, the speed with which China has, gone backwards is extraordinary. I'm optimistic about that simply because I think they've shot their bolt. Had they waited,
I hope you're right. I am too when I'm in a happier mood. Mm. And like I say, I hope you're right.
Yeah.
And I'm not as pessimistic about America either, because I think it's easy to confuse basic common sense about how the world works with being an academic, which is the opposite. higher education in America is in headlong decline at the moment, and that will have consequences for, it already is having consequences. There are already lots of American men who look at universities and say, well, that's not worth it. And the number of university students in America among men is in headlong decline at the moment, and I'm not surprised.
No, no.
And all these women who are getting cushy and stupid degrees are going to be despised.
Yeah.
If insofar as they're not already despised as having made a very bad decision. They're going to be treated like people who've been to finishing schools rather than people who've been to proper schools.
I was thinking that that Monty Python sketch, the upper class twit of the year, I think they're going to be in that category for very long.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, that's
I hope that's true, and I think it will be true. The point is, universities can't assume that they're going to go on running society the way they did when they were at their best, which was Germany, late 19th century, and America and Britain, and everywhere, actually, early 20th century, where real science was taught by real scientists, and real debates were had about what was the cleverest explanation for this or that, and useful products resulted, you know, flat screen TVs and electric light bulbs and all sorts of gadgets that you can't really imagine being invented without a background in the science, the relevant science.
I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe. I was going to say I wasn't sure that much came out of English universities or English university engineering departments, but I could be wrong on that. I think the
quality of scientific education in English universities in the 20th century did have economic benefits. I don't think they're necessarily very good at innovating as much as the early gadgeteers were, but they're very good at running good industries, you know, producing, I don't know, things like agricultural, chemicals for farming and whatnot.
Do we have any examples of this? It isn't, you know, I always thought with Russ British it was always blokes in sheds.
Well, I think it was. I think that was the glory days of the British liftoff. But I think the British have done pretty well since then. We're not poor, are we?
No, we still do fantastic things.
Hmm.
In the weirdest industries and not where you would expect. And it's often the real cutting-edge stuff that the British are still very good.
Yeah, and I think the English are like that. They regard work as a bit of a game, whereas the Germans regard it as work.
Yes.
I think the Germans, their mistake is to treat warfare as a game.
They do?
Well, yeah,
I thought it was the opposite was the case. I mean, the general staff takes it very seriously, or did, when it existed.
Well, my understanding of Germany is that it is tactically brilliant at war and strategically grotesque at war.
Yes, and that would certainly, the First World War certainly feeds into that. They just balls it up totally. And it only lasted long because they were so tactically astute. But even then, I mean, ultimately, if your strategy is... Well, it's not quite true, but if you've got the strategy wrong, ultimately it doesn't matter how good your tactics are. It's not going to help you. I was listening to a podcast only this morning about German code breaking in the Second World War. The first thing is, yes, there was German code breaking, and secondly, it was quite good. But they got to the stage that by 1943, 44, it didn't matter how good their code breaking was. They were still going to lose. Because they couldn't do anything with information.
The Second World War is a story of Anglo-American excellence in logistics and factory running.
Yeah.
You know, War Factories, that wonderful show on I forget which, one of these obscure TV channels.
Yesterday, I think, is the one where it shows up. But if it's on Yesterday, it's probably appeared on Discovery beforehand. So, yeah, but it'll be one of those. Those ones, and yes, it is. I absolutely agree with you. It's a fantastic show because it shows.
The trouble with the Germans was they produced far too many weapons in far too small numbers.
Like the Fokker Wolf 190, which is supposed to be a great plane, but small numbers. ME-262, great plane, small numbers. A V-2 rocket.
Had a
few thousand of those, that might have made a difference. Or Tiger tanks, again. A classic example of this sort of thing.
Whereas the Americans and the British filled the skies with bombers and filled the world with, things like jeeps and trucks. Which the Germans didn't really do properly.
They filled Russia with trucks as well, I believe.
Oh, yes.
Which is incredibly important. By the way, going back to the First World War, there's one guy out there called Jeff Thompson who is the expert on logistics, and he will bore the pants off people about talking about trucks in the First World War and how big a difference they made. Because it was the only real way of getting stuff up to the front line or near to the front line.
Well, the other alternative was horse power. Horses.
Yeah, and in some cases,
Nazis famously made use of on a huge scale.
Yeah. Yeah,
until they ran out.
Indeed. But they need a lot of fodder, horses, and they die and stuff like that.
But it's not the usual idea of the Germans that they depended upon horse-drawn transport. But they did.
Yeah. Both World Wars, as I understand it. One of the reasons why they were, had problems. Yeah. Right, we've gone off topic pretty well here.
I think we were bound to, because what is there to say about the medieval era other than how miserable it was for most people and how limited life was for most people? You were either a peasant or a soldier. And
I suppose we could ask the question, where would you prefer to live in Western Europe in the Middle Ages?
Well,
it's probably Italy, actually, kind of think of it.
An improvement because of its natural defences as they got better. So I would say I like Finlay Dunnicky's description of how Britain got lucky. I think that's right.
But I believe most of Europe, still is actually, most of Europe is enthralled to medieval Italy. All those churches and Michelangelo frescoes and this sort of thing. The Renaissance. I think it sounds to me as if that reputation is deserved.
And also enormous fortifications. These spiky town centres with kind of spikes reaching out into the countryside with which to defend the city centre. They all had to do that. Because if they didn't, they'd be...
There's a famous French fort designer, isn't it, whose name begins with a V, and I can't know what his name is, who designed these things, isn't there?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I was very lucky. I went to stay with our mutual friend Antoine Clark in Paris. I think it was 2013, I think it was. I just stayed there a week. It was horribly cold and uncomfortable. But there was an exhibition of models of French towns, which were all created for military purposes to educate the French officer class. And you suddenly got a feeling of how militarized France had to be.
Yes.
Because that was the world, it was conquer or be conquered.
Yes, which really does feed into what Finlay Dunnicky said.
Yeah. Whereas the English had a bit of maneuvering space that could keep conquerors at bay and start to think in other ways, with the results that the world is still benefiting from, I would argue.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't argue against that at all. I think it's a very good pamphlet. Certainly one that inspired me at the time.